destination is the stars.
The Sci-Fi Roundtable podcasts. Today we are covering fantasy influences in our writing. With me is Wendy Van Camp and Angelique. I'm going to pronounce your last name wrong, so I'm going to let you start by introducing yourself.
Angelique Anderson.
You write?
I do. I write a lot. I write fantasy fiction. I also write sci-fi. My favorite probably genre that I've been kind of dabbling in for the past couple years is steampunk fantasy. I feel like that kind of marries both elements of fantasy and sci-fi together, so it's been a really good fit for me. I also have a biography. I've done a few other things, anthologies, news articles, stuff like that. So pretty much anything that I feel inspired to do, I do.
Okay. Wendy, tell us a little about you.
Well, I am an author and poet. I write science fiction. I do write some fantasy. I also write a little bit of Austin Regency influenced books. Generally, my fantasy work is in short story form, which you can find up on Medium. But eventually, I'll probably have some fantasy novels in the pipeline. I've been reading fantasy genre since I was, you know, knee-high to a grasshopper. And I do enjoy it. And I really, as a writer, love the ability to create a world from the ground up, including all the physical elements, too, in your magic system. So it's a very intensive genre to write because you have to do everything. But it can be very rewarding, too.
I'm Eric Klein. I'm predominantly a sci-fi writer, although lately I've been writing a lot of fantasy stuff that we refer to as marketing material. And have a number of influences that have gotten into my novel, which is a hard sci-fi book, but there's a place for fantasy in that too, even sci-fantasy, if you would. So let's start with an easy question for the two of you. What fantasy author has inspired or influenced your writing the most?
I definitely have to say for me, it was C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. That series got me through quite a bit growing up as a child. I've moved around a lot. I was in foster care. When I found the Chronicles of Narnia and fell into the wardrobe with the kids and, you know, met the witch and the lion and all that, I mean, it absolutely just changed my life for me at that age. I mean, I wrote stuff when I was younger, mostly like scary stories, like Alvin Schwartz's Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. I loved that series. And so that made me want to write. So I started writing little dark stories as a kid because I had a dark life. And so I wanted to express that. And then as I got older, you know, and just wanted to escape reality in general, I'm like, I really want to write fantasy stuff. But I didn't start writing like that until my 20s. And then just over the past few years, that influence consistently comes up, you know, and the allegory and just everything, it just consistently comes up. And it's always influenced my writing from day one. And I've always told my readers, like, you know, I really love Chronicles of Narnia. My first series was based on Chronicles of Narnia and just how C.S. Lewis wove those worlds together. And I'm actually redoing that series right now. It's getting a whole rewrite, which has been super fun because I'm like, wow, when I first started, I didn't know nothing. So that was my first influence. I think as an adult, you know, with the rise of self-publishing and stuff, there's been so many more along the way. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Marissa Meyer, but she does a steampunk fantasy series. It marries like the fairy tales, like Cinderella, you know, Snow White. It marries them into this whole new like world of steampunk. It's just fantastic. It's called The Lunar Chronicles. I'm sure a lot of people have heard of it, but I started reading that and I was like, oh my gosh, this is who I want to be. And Bella Forrest,
but yeah, I can see where you've got where it's got similarities.
Yeah, and then Bella Forrest, who is just a freaking whirlwind in her own right. She has like 140 or 170 novels out, and she just keeps kicking butt and just keeps putting stuff out. And you know, her stories are fun, they're entertaining. So yeah, those I think would be my three influences right now.
I wanted to just say I loved Cinder. It's just a beautiful book.
It's amazing, right? I love it. Yeah.
It's an awesome book, but I would call it science fantasy rather than steampunk.
I think I agree with you, Eric. It's not a pure fantasy. It is more science. It's a blending. It is definitely.
Once you start putting in spaceships and moon colonies, it's harder to make it a steampunk concept. It's definitely high-tech circuitry rather than steam-powered. But I understand that the style is very steampunk, even if the tech isn't. So I can understand that one would be an influence.
Fantasy-wise, I do have a lot of influences. I think Tolkien was probably my first one, because I wrote my first book when I was only like 4 or 5 years old. All in child scrawl, and it was a fantasy featuring dwarves and orcs and all that. So even though I hadn't even read Tolkien, it had already filtered in through the media to me and was influencing me. I don't think I actually read the books until I was a teenager, though. But another major influence would be Lewis Carroll and Alice in Wonderland. I know Alice in Wonderland is really more of a sarcastic comment on Victorian society, but it was all coached in a very fanciful way, and I think it definitely does qualify as being a fantasy. And again, it goes back to my comment about creating an entire world and the way it works. Lewis Carroll definitely mastered at that, considering how his book has endured well over 200 years now. I think those are my two major ones. Most of my other favorite authors are science fiction authors. But I think those two are definitely in the mix there for me.
Okay, it's interesting that you should go back to Lewis Carroll. My primary influences, although I've read lots of fantasy and have enjoyed much of it, the two that tend to come back and be the ones that literally influenced my novel in this particular case is more Jonathan Swift in Gulliver's Travels. And Shakespeare, which are definitively much older school kind of classic fantasy stuff. And yes, they were both satires in many cases, being Endians and Little Endians and who's going to fight for what. But the other side of that would be The Phantom Tollbooth, which is kind of Gulliver's Travels for kids.
I love that one, too. I love the movie that came out in the 60s. That was one of my favorite films when I was a kid.
Yes.
Excellent.
When I started writing my novel, Gulliver's Travels and how he describes each of the places he's going to and experiences, which is a kind of political satire on some aspect of the world that is around him, was very much the concept that I put in when I did my cruise through the solar system, visiting each colony and kind of giving a Gulliver-like treatment to it and viewing of it as the people, as BJ went and actually saw each one and got to experience what was perfectly normal and completely, what the hell were they thinking on each of the colonies? So if you had to give somebody a must read, if you haven't read it, it's the fantasy book you have to go back and read, what would you say it is, Wendy?
I would have to say it's Tolkien. There's a saying that says there are two types of people in the world, those who have read Tolkien and those who are waiting to read Tolkien. It's a major influence on the genre. In fact, I think it's the cornerstone that created the fantasy genre as a novel. And its influence just permeates everything. So it's always good to go back and read the source material. And frankly, The Lord of the Rings is considered classic literature anyway. So it's always a great start for fantasy.
Okay, I'm not sure I would agree that it is the beginning of, but it's certainly made more popular. More towards the beginning, I would be going towards the Arthurian stuff.
That could be. Although I consider that more legend and myth than I do actual fantasy stories. But I don't know, did the Crystal Cave and all those, did that come before Tolkien or did it come after? You remember?
That one came, I think that came after.
I think that's Mary Stuart. Yeah, I think she was influenced by Tolkien's success and then... Yes. Well, came out with the Crystal Cave and all the Merlin stories.
Right. I was thinking more the Once and Future King, which was originally based on the...
T.H. White, yes.
Right. The story that came out like 100 years before Tolkien was writing. So kind of... There was a lot of myth. There's a lot of stories that Tolkien went and based his world on. Mm-hmm. But elves and dwarves were pre-existing concepts in literature prior to him codifying them, if you would.
Yeah, but I think fantasy as we think of it really started with him. He pulled all these elements together to create it. It kind of like how Tim Powers and Blaylock kind of created steampunk by pulling all these Victorian elements together and created a whole new subgenre of their own, too. I think Tolkien had that influence on fantasy. That's just my opinion.
But, no, modern fantasy, it's definitely his game. He played it and defined it. Non-modern, there's options that came before that he kind of played on. What he did and what he created was incredibly useful and gave a common basis. So if you describe someone as being elf-like, people have an image. It may not be the one you meant, but they have an image based on the books or, unfortunately, the movies.
Oh, I don't know. Orlando Bloom or... yes. Well,
there were things that they did to the movies that were creative license that Tolkien would have had a fit if he had been alive for.
Yeah, but even so, I think Jackson really came as close as you probably could to being...
Until you threw in the love interest.
He did take some directorial license, but all filmmakers do. And I've seen so many books that have just been so butchered by movies that I don't have that complaint with what Jackson did with Lord of the Rings. But I agree, it's not perfect. I mean, film and books are such a different medium. You cannot go into the depth that a book does with a story on film because it would just get muddied and lost visually.
I would agree with that with one exception.
Yes?
There is only one case where the movie far exceeded the content or the premise of the book.
Which one was that in your opinion?
And it involves dragons.
Oh.
How to Train Your Dragon is the fantasy novel that is horrible to read but awesome to watch.
Oh, the hit movie. Yes. I haven't even
realized. I second that.
The adaptation.
Okay. Yes, because in the original book, Toothless is a boxer-sized dragon that is cheap, lazy, and not willing to do anything, and has to be carried from place to place. So he's a stupid little green, ugly dragon that has no personality and no involvement, and his keeper has to go out and do all of these things, including carrying his own dragon. turning it around the way they did and making him the Black Fury and everything else made for a significantly better story. And I've read all five books in the original set. The other one that surprises me is anybody who's actually read The Wizard of Oz versus watched The Wizard of Oz, big differences there also.
Yes. I can argue that maybe the film version might be a little better than the book, although Frank Baum definitely has his fan base.
People think that The Wizard of Oz is a standalone.
Oh, it's not.
There's a significant number of books, I don't remember if it's 8 or 10, that come after it, that are truly amazing view into the world that Frank created, that I truly regret that they never turned into proper movies.
Well, you know, maybe Netflix or... Amazon Prime will hear you. They certainly are turning a lot of fantasy and sci-fi books into series these days. And that might be a great one for the kids. You never know.
If they could do a better job of that one than the John Carter of Mars series movie.
I love the movie. I even met Andrew Stanton during his promo of the film. And, you know, it's a shame that he never was able to do all three movies. I'm sure he would have done an outstanding job. He definitely modernized the story enough. Because let's face it, The Princess of Mars was written 100 years ago, and it does have very Victorian sensibilities that don't necessarily play well today. But the problem with the film was so many people had stolen from Edgar Rice Burroughs and his original concept of the John Carter of Mars series, that people thought it was derivative of these other works when in actuality it was the other way around.
My complaint about it was more they wanted to create this whole movie universe and create a whole series like Harry Potter's or Star Trek's or things like that. And in the end, They just did not know what they were doing, and they marketed it exactly for the wrong things.
The marketing was dismal, and calling the movie John Carter instead of John Carter of Mars, which people in the genre would have recognized, was the biggest mistake ever. And I truly believe the marketing department killed that film. The film actually has a cult following now because it is a decent film. I mean, it's a very entertaining, lighthearted adventure. And I do recommend it, by the way. But yeah, the Disney marketing totally ruined it. And I think they had their eyes on Marvel at that time. And once they got Marvel, they figured, we don't need John Carter. And they just tossed it into the basement.
Which sucks, because I agree with you. It was I really enjoyed that movie a lot. I do think the Disney marketing definitely killed it.
Yeah, it was a reasonably good adaptation, because they got the concept, they got the world, they got the peoples, they got the personalities. Right. Okay, they made a couple of changes. They did away with the Civil War and slavery and a couple other things that were not as palatable to a modern audience, so they modernized parts of it. But otherwise, it was a really good adaptation comparatively.
And honestly, I think A Princess of Mars was one of my very, it was the book that got me into science fiction and being a science fiction / fantasy writer in the first place. And it's one of those books, too, that kind of is both. It does have a lot of science elements, although, you know, again, it was written 100 years ago when we did not have as much knowledge about the Red Planet as we do now. It's based more on the science of its time. But it has so many fantasy elements and Victorian sensibilities. For instance, the projection method that John Carter goes to Mars in the book is actually a very well, seances and astral projection was a very common kind of thing at his time. It wasn't something out of the blue that he developed. There were people that credibly believed in this kind of thing at the time of the writing of this book. So it was a really interesting blending of fantasy ideas combined with science. And I assume that's why it's a classic to this day. People still read Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Yes. It was a wonderful writing. Although, to be honest, I personally think he went a little too far on it. By book 8, it was really kind of like, okay, this is getting boring. By book 14, it was like, okay, let it die already.
Well, actually, John Carter, I believe, only has 7 or 8 books, and there's some thought that maybe the last one wasn't even written by him, but it was written by maybe his son or somebody else capitalizing on the name. But yeah, it really, I would only recommend the first 3, maybe 4 books of the series.
Yeah.
And after that, they get a little, I guess I really like the character of John Carter. I love Deja Thoris, and I love Sola. You know, Sola was a princess in her own right, even though she was a green Martian woman. But in if you think about it, she was also a princess as well, even though she was not treated that way.
Well,
so
believe
it or not, I've kind of identified with Sola a lot more than I did some other characters. But she was a very strong female presence in writing. And back then, that was just unheard of. So kudos to Edgar Rice Burroughs for having strong women with agency in his books, even at that time period.
There were a lot of books, and the ones that involved John Carter were the better one. Moving on to other things, Angelique, what would you say is the must-read novel in the fantasy realm as far as you're concerned?
I have so many, but I'm just going to go back to basics with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I really cannot say enough how much that book just influenced me. And it's, you know, it's timeless. I have 4 girls, and they, you know, we watched that with them when they were younger. And now they are 8, 10, 14, and 17. And it's still, you know, the BBC version was great. Obviously, it's never going to be as good as the book. But, you know, they've all read it. And it's something that they all enjoy at different levels. And I've loved, even as an adult, you know, it's kind of one of those books that grows with you. It means different things at different times. And I don't think you can touch that as far as a novel goes. And so I will always say The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Okay.
You know, I believe Tolkien was writing Lord of the Rings while Lewis was writing his Narnia series, and they were in the same writing group together. With the Inklings. So the two books definitely influenced each other.
Okay. I just took a quick look. They just put out book 12 this year in the John Carter series.
Oh, somebody must have picked up the series then.
It's supposed to be the 6-1 John Carter of Mars, Gods of the Forgotten. Huh. By Jiri Gravel.
Okay. Is that through the publisher? It decided to pick up somebody and...
It's through the estate. So Edgar Rice Burroughs Incorporated released this.
Interesting. I'll have to talk to my friends who hang out in Tarzana and see what they have to say about that. I had not realized they were starting that up.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised. Mm-hmm. Okay. If I had to throw out one out there that is less well known but incredibly worth reading, I'd probably use Bridge of Birds.
I don't believe I've heard of that one.
It's a mythological alternative China and a crime sleuth kind of story. So you've got this little town that suddenly every year they're getting into the picking of the mulberry leaves because of the silk industry. And suddenly all of the kids between 6 and 14 pass out, and every day at the same time wake up, sit up, start doing this hand rhyme with their everything else, and then go back to sleep. And they're in a coma. Nothing will wake them. So they hire a great philosopher to help them figure out what's going on. And he, being a natural philosopher who had done really well on the exams, they go out, he and number 10 Ox, who is this big bull of a guy who has been sent to help him, do a whole tour of the variation of China to try to figure out what's going on, and basically keep getting told, right quest, wrong reason. So it's a really interesting, convoluted story.
That's interesting.
Angelique, what would you say is the a must-read, less well-known fantasy
book? Oh, boy. can you come back to me? I need to think about that for a minute.
I don't know. Wendy, you got one?
I wanted to talk a little bit about Susan Cooper's series, The Dark is Rising. Books included in are like Silver on the Tree. And this was a series I read when I was very young. And it was also a big influence on me. And even though it was very popular at the time, I think it's kind of fallen away, that people don't necessarily remember it anymore. And I think it's a shame, because I think as an author, she had two series. One featured a male protagonist, which is The Dark is Rising. And the other one featured a female protagonist, which was her Indigo series. And both of them are really interesting. But the Dark is Rising series has definitely been the one that's gotten the most notice. I believe it even was adapted into a film at one point. It's a young adult. I think it's one that's definitely worth looking at if you like young adult adventures and you like magic and coming of age stories. And this series, the first one is called Oversea Under Stone. The next one is The Dark is Rising, then Green Witch, The Great King, and Silver on the Tree, which is the one I think I remember the most. But excellent fantasy series, especially if you're looking to maybe hook a young person into the fantasy genre. I would actually pick this one over Tolkien, believe it or not, because I think Tolkien is more for adults at this point.
Yeah, I was thinking about a fantasy series that I really enjoy is The Wheel of Time, but I feel like that's a well-known series. So I'm like, I don't want to mention that, but I mean, I love Wheel of Time. I've actually started rereading it, but that's a little bit a deeper level of reading than for young adults. I read it when I was a kid, but
it's a very long series. I mean, you've got to really be dedicated, and I like it too.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Robert Jordan, the author, was not able to finish it. Brandon Sanderson, also a very famous author now, but at the time relatively unknown, took over the series and finished it at the request.
Which that just amazes me, because I did not, like, I think Brandon Sanderson's great, but, you know, for him to take over that series, which is such a, also kind of timeless, I just, yes. I mean, that blows my mind. Like he was kind of a nobody, and now he's finishing this freaking epic fantasy series, and like I mean, that's, I mean, that's gold.
Stormlight series that he's writing currently.
I haven't started reading it. I did hear about it though. It's on my TBR.
I'm actually reading The Way of Kings right now. It's
very
good. Nice. Although I fell in love with his new series called Skyward, which that's more science fiction, so I didn't really want to bring it up here. But yeah. I love Skyward. It's beautifully done.
I'll check that out.
His fantasy series right now is The Way of Kings, and it's called the Starlight series. But he had another one which started with his first book that was called Elantris, and he had a very elaborate, unique magic system developed in that book. But I think when he finished Elantris, I believe he did a sequel, but he kind of fell away from it and went into his Mistborn series, which is also a fantasy. One thing I like about Brandon Sanderson's fantasies is he's a master of world building, and you have to be.
Absolutely.
Author. And he has created magic systems that are just so unique and so intricate. And he is so consistent when he writes in these worlds. It's just amazing. It's almost like the world itself becomes a character to draw you in. Yes. And I've been a big fan of Sanderson. And if you're a writer, he does, he's a professor at BYU, and he actually teaches a lot about his techniques, and you can see it for free on YouTube. And I highly recommend if you are a writer, you aspire to write fantasy, you should look into his free series on YouTube. I think it'd be a great benefit to a fantasy writer in particular, but to any writer, really.
Yeah, definitely.
His techniques are so spot on.
Okay. Here's a challenging question. At what point do we define the line between fantasy and science fiction?
I mean,
earned science fantasy, fantasy or science fiction? I mean, you've got flying dragons, but you also have a spaceship that crash landed.
Well, let's look at The Dragon Riders of Pern by Annie McCaffrey.
That's what I'm saying.
Classic fantasy, but you know, to her dying breath, Annie McCaffrey said, no, by darn, this is science fiction, because there was a science fiction concept for everything. The flying dragons were created by the human beings via gene splicing or whatever through their own biological technology. Yeah. So, I mean, and they arrived there on a spaceship. And so, in effect, it really is science fiction. At its core, but of course it follows a lot of fantasy tropes. So people, for some reason, considered it to be a fantasy. That's why when we initially talked about that, even though I'm a huge Annie McCaffrey fan, her books are not really fantasy. And I didn't want to put them forth that way, because I'd like to be respectful to the author and her wishes, even though she's no longer with us.
That's why I was asking. It's like, okay, you look at Pern, you look at Darkover.
Darkover's another good one about that,
And then you've got the Celtiad Chronicles.
Right.
He's less well known, but here you've got science fiction and fantasy, spaceships and magic kind of mixed together, which is a good line.
Wasn't it Clark who said any significantly advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic?
Correct. I mean,
a lot of our day-to-day that we live a couple hundred years ago would have been considered magic, and we just accepted as technology. My main series that I'm working on, unfortunately the books are not out yet, but I have a series that's called, I call it Steampunk Wonderland. It's loosely based off of characters from Lewis Carroll, but it's a universe of my own creation, and it's basically looks like steampunk science fiction with fantasy elements from Lewis Carroll. And most people that read it initially think it's a fantasy, but in actuality, the fantasy is science fiction in the book. It's just you have to read it to understand that as time goes on through the world building. But that's a case, I think, with what we're talking about. There's a very thin line. And, you know, I almost wonder if the line is, if your magic system is plausible enough that it could eventually be technology, then I would say it's almost, it's science fantasy. But if it's the fantasy elements are just so outrageous. We're not really outrageous, but so unexplainable than maybe they do belong in fantasy. So like in ancient myth, the power of the gods, that would be fantasy, right? Whether it's, I don't know. Angelique, what do you think?
I'm going to try not to be sound so opinionated, but
I'm sure people will be sending their hate mail to me.
No. I'm saying because I have very strong reservations about this, and probably this is where I fail as a writer, is that even though there's legalistic boundaries that say, well, this classifies this book as sci-fi because it has these elements, and this classifies this book as fantasy because it has these elements. For me, I don't feel like there's a definitive line. I mean, I know that there are authors who live and breathe and die by that, but for me, it's, you know, in fantasy, you have to have elements of sci-fi for it to work. I mean, there's no getting around it. And in sci-fi, I mean, you have to have elements of fantasy to make that work. And so, you know, to say, well, there's a line that this makes this book sci-fi or this makes this book fantasy, it's like, that's hard for me. And I blur the lines quite often. I mean, in my own writing, you'll see what I'm talking about. That's what I write. So I'm not just saying this, like, you know, there's technology, there's dragons. I mean, I don't really know how to say there needs to be a line or there is a line, because for me, there's not. You need both to make a book readable and fun. And I'm not speaking legalistically. I know legalistically there is a line, but for me, I feel like both elements can make a book. And yes, it can lean more towards one way or more towards another, but I don't think that there's a definitive line, unless you're being legalistic, of course.
I think I'm with you on that, Angelique. I mean, I know there kind of is, but it's such a great thing. Whenever I write fantasy, I have to have a logical sense of the world in my mind. And in the end, it almost always grounds it in so much reality that it could almost be science fiction, even though it's a fantasy. But that's just my personal, because I've seen other authors just go completely wild with their magic systems. And clearly it is fantasy and could be nuts. So it may be just up to us individual authors how we handle it.
I would tend to agree with that. Lucas was definitely writing fantasy.
Yes, space opera, absolutely.
Oh, no, it's space opera with magic welders and swords. Okay, yes. He made them fancy, but that's effectively what it was. And it's a very fine line, mostly marketing related.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And that's why I said I think that's where I fail as an author, because, you know, I want to classify books a certain way. And I know that when readers pick them up, they're going to be like, oh, this is a fantasy, blah, blah, blah. But for me, it just feels like boxing myself in. And I think that's why I really lean towards steampunk, is because I can mix both worlds and marry it. And nobody's going to shoot me down, because that's what I've done.
You should never describe yourself as a failure as a writer. Now, come on.
A failure as a writer is I never actually got to put words down.
The whole marketing thing, it just eludes me. So I don't know.
Marketing is a different topic. I'm not even going to go there.
Because
that's a much more complicated many novels have made an attempt to cross that line deliberately with their eyes open and intentionally. The trilogy or the double trilogy of the juxtaposition books, New Adept.
Oh. Yes.
Piers Anthony, you've got two overlapping worlds, one science, one fantasy, one magic works, one science works.
I really loved how he did that. That was an incredible concept.
The first three books were awesome. The fourth book was okay. After that, the series just got a little okay. You're beating your horse more than dead. We've passed Tartar, and now we're getting into mush.
You know, to be honest, I can kind of say the same thing with the Xanth books. I mean, the first one won an award, and I actually enjoyed the first three or four or five of them. And after that, I just got lost. I think he's on like book 100 of that series. Speaking of fantasy, though, that is a classic fantasy. I mean, his whole world is fully magic. It's a world of puns.
Xanth is not fully magic. Only the state of Florida, which is known as Xanth in his world, is magical. The rest of the world once you cross into Georgia equivalent, isn't. That's what made that.
Yes. But the books themselves are fantasy books.
Yes. But having read several interviews with him, he intended it to be a trilogy, except the fans kept sending him more and more pun inspiration. And he literally said at one point, people are throwing money at me to just sit down and put the ideas together and just get cash for nothing. Who am I to say no?
So it definitely ran away with itself. And I think the Adept series started to do that too. But I agree that the first couple of books were really amazing. And I do recommend them. But unfortunately with Anthony, he always starts out with these great concepts. And then I think he just writes them too long. The Reapers is another example of that. The term Reaper has actually entered into pop culture, but it originally was his idea in a book called On a Pale Horse. And Reapers are people that collect the souls for the dead or whatever. And the Incarnations of Immortality, another good fantasy series, but it does mix a lot of science fiction elements with it as well.
Very much so.
Although I would classify it as a fantasy.
Yes. I am truly awed at the fact that he was able to write it, because it was a 5-book series that he plotted out and planned very carefully. Book 6 and 7 were not intended to be written. Somebody waved too many zeros on a check at him to say no. But the concept of writing 5 books that in many cases occur over the same overlapping 2 weeks to a month time period from 5 different points of view, starting earlier or later or whatever things were, was truly an amazing concept. I don't know anybody else who's gotten that far into it. Some authors just go out and find the gimmick and really do it like, oh my God, where did you come up with that?
It's a very unique series, one that I would recommend. But
awesome series.
Anthony, he always starts out great. And then I think he just stays with the ideas too long. He doesn't know how to end things well, I guess.
Depends. Microscope was a one-shot. It worked fine. Other things that he did as one-off books and other things worked fine. It just, some of his things were just so grandiose that it kind of started to fray at the end.
He did one about a dictator that was really interesting, although that's science fiction, so I don't know if I want to go too much into that. But at least that one, he ended well. It followed a plan and it ended.
The first 5, even the 6th book of the Incarnation series, going from death, Gaia, time, going through each of them the way he didn't end, in a very much the same way Piers Anthony did with some of these things, personifying these general concepts from culture worked well. Getting to the devil for love of evil was really well done. Makes the devil a reasonable and sympathetic protagonist.
I agree.
But
that was the On the Pale Horse book, I believe.
Once you get to the end, number 6 is For Love of Evil, where he takes the devil starting back during as a priest during the Black Plague. And the Spanish Inquisition, and then follows him through until the point where he's now overlapping with the other books.
Okay.
And the last one is End Eternity, where they're basically voting to replace God. The devil's dead girlfriend, who is a ghost that he wears on a drop of blood on his wrist, basically becomes the candidate because of what she's been through. And it's kind of like, okay, this one, okay, you went just a little more esoteric on that.
I can't say I agree with all his concepts, but they're always interesting. That's
always incredibly creative.
Yes.
But a lot of the things that we're seeing in modern stories are somebody took an old concept, polished off the serial number, brightened it up, gave it a new coat of paint to kind of twist the world around. And that's pretty much what we've got. Shakespeare, all of the Greek mythos. I mean, if you look at the Greek mythology, it is somewhere between science fiction and steampunk. Okay, you've got a synthetic arm created. You've got a wind-up owl for Athena. You've got all sorts of what we would consider high-tech concepts, and cyborgs or androids today were considered perfectly reasonable concepts for these.
Now, was the wind-up owl actually part of Greek mythology, or was that Harry Hasselhoff or the filmmaker back in the 60s. Because I know in Clash of the Titans, it was represented, and even in the reboot, they brought it back as kind of a joke. But I don't know who was necessarily part of classic myth. I think that was a modern construct on the ancient myth that when they redid the movie. Because I know they had Pegasus come in, and they hit all the ancient myths in the movie, but they modernized it a little bit in the 60s. And then again, when they did the reboot, I mean, it was very different. But it was not that close to the classic tale, except that they just had some of the fantastical elements, like the creatures or whatever in it.
I'll have to look that one back up. I'll have to look that up again.
All our stories are reflections of our own culture, in a sense, and our own sensibilities. And every generation makes changes on the old tales. And that's just part of the natural process of how culture develops, I guess, in a sense, in our sense of story. As writers, we must start with the world itself and then go from that point with fantasy. Because if you're not consistent, I think you suspend the ability to believe is just lost on the reader.
The fantasy Deus Ex Machina, or the mystery writers and the butler did it, or the science fiction and then they woke up or turned off the holodeck or whatever else concepts, are tried and true tropes that are overdone and frequently a cop-out. But yeah, there are a number of really good things in fantasy, a lot of really good writers. Going back to Tolkien for a second, The Hobbit was deliberately a kid's book. The Lord of the Rings was deliberately not. And the difference led to some serious discrepancies between the two in the world.
Well, I think Tolkien was more in, I think his love was more in language, to be honest. And that he developed entire languages for his world. The poetry that he wrote for the elves is beautiful. A lot of his already... has been set to music, and you can hear that in going into the films, mm-hmm. or just listening to your local folk singers. They often sing Tolkien at the cons and whatnot. I think in Tolkien's case, I mean, his book is really, I think what sets it apart even today, even though it's become a derivative in so many places, or rather people have used it so much, I think his love of language and the way he brought so many ancient myths and legends together to create his world, it made it seem so real. And I think in fantasy, that's something I personally look for, is how real the fantasy world feels. Too often, a fantasy writer will basically create a world that's just so much like our own that it almost makes me wonder why I'm going there to read it. Because for fantasy, at least, I like to go to a fantasy book to escape our world and visit another world. But the human interaction there is the same. It still has to be believable in a way that the people are believable. They need to be people that I can want to follow, want to understand. Or want to hate, whatever, you know, for the villain's case. But you want to be emotionally invested in it. That's good in all writing needs that. But I think in fantasy, it's something that is more strongly needed. Just because the worlds are so different, that the inner world of the fantasy world that is created is so different from our own, we need that emotional human contact to ground us there. And I think that's kind of maybe a trope or something that needs to be part of every fantasy story, in my opinion. Okay, Angelique?
Yeah. I'm just listening.
Oh, well, bless you. You need to speak up a little more.
Wow, that's nothing I've never been told.
Well, you're a successful writer. We want to hear from you.
I think success is in the eye of the beholder.
You've managed to hit publish. That counts as success. Financial success.
That's true.
Is another story.
You are a success. I agree with Eric.
There are different milestones. I started, I completed, I edited, I actually said, oh my God, I'm going to let the rest of the world look at this. Releasing it to the wild is success. Scary as hell, but success. Financial success is a different category.
I agree.
True. Okay, so we're leaving financial of it. Yes, then I'm quite successful.
There you go.
Thank you. The things that seem to be expected right now from fantasy stories, based on what has come in the past, tends to be a map, frequently a family tree or genealogy of one or more of the main characters.
Yes and no, but yeah.
It's very common. It's not required, but it's very common. And frequently a pronunciation or translation glossary.
Okay. You know, even Dune had that, but you needed it.
So you've got a whole bunch of these things that have become not quite required, but almost expected. The map more than anything else. In many cases with some authors, I'm beginning to suspect that the pronunciation guide or the lineage tree is more a concept for stuffing and getting more pages than an absolute necessity. But I know my wife and daughter will pore over those in detail before and during reading the story so they understand the language, the concept, the meaning of words.
That's an interesting thing, Eric. You know, it's funny. I am developing a map for my Steampunk Wonderland series. And I don't see publishing without a map. So I'll agree with you on that. I didn't think about genealogy, but I think in my book's case, the family trees are not that extensive that I don't know if a reader would necessarily not be able to follow it. Now, if you're doing a story that goes over several generations, I can see having the map to help make things more clear. So, but I think maybe that's, you're right. Maybe it is just something that's commonplace. You know, now that we indie publish a lot of things, because I'm an indie author and I'm proud to be one, we have the option of putting in a lot of things because we control our books. So if we want to put in this material in the back, we can, or we can offer it as an extra to the fans on our website, mm-hmm. perhaps, and they can go and do it that way if we don't want to include it in the actual book. But, you know, 20 years ago, this kind of stuff was not possible. So perhaps things are changing in that we are able to offer it, and so we are doing so.
20 years ago, it was rare but existed. I'm thinking some of the books that I've read that truly would have been beneficial for the reader, if the author at least had done their own map for their own use, let alone publishing. The first four books of Terry Pratchett's Discworld series are very inconsistent on where things on in Ankh-Morpork. And one minute the Mendodrome is in the middle, then it's on the river, then it's in the, it's like that things moved around based on the story until some fans went and started codifying it and gave him a map based on their understanding of his descriptions, at which point he realized that he needed to have something more serious and put it in.
You know, isn't that a delight of our time, though, that the fans themselves help form the stories? I know some authors don't agree with that. They go, this is my story, I'd say what it is and whatever. But I actually enjoy this input from the fan base coming up and influencing the author, and like Piers Anthony, like you said, they throw enough money at him, he writes the book. Sometimes it's not good, but other times I think it's really part of the creative process. And mm-hmm. I do know when I listen to some of the A-list authors out there at cons, they seem very appreciative of the fans and their ideas and what they want. And they want to incorporate all of that. And I think it makes for stronger storytelling.
I would agree. There are pluses and minuses. The primary minus, I recall the story of Larry Niven and the WorldCom in Boston in the early 70s, where the MIT students were all marching through chanting, the ring world is unstable.
oh, no. You know, poor Larry Niven, he's gotten some. Then, of course, he accidentally put the wrong direction in his story in the ring world. And yeah. It took him decades to live it down. I've met him, by the way. We were at a con in the green room together, and I got a chance to chat with him. A very delightful man. But it's a shame that some people do take this kind of connection to that point and cause grief instead of being more inclusive and being more supportive, because it's hard to be a writer. We're kind of, even without a pandemic or whatever, we're still locked away by ourselves most of the time. And it'd be nice if people would be a little more understanding of that, I guess.
Well, in his particular case, he did not take it personally and went back and then proceeded to put out 4 more books in the series, which he hadn't intended to write until they started chanting at him.
Yeah, I really enjoy his writing, though. And I loved his, not only his Ring World series, but the Smoke Ring as well. And I understand he and his, is it Brett Benford he's writing them with? I forget who his co-writer is, but he is starting another science fiction series based on another rather unusual, stellar kind of concept. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what he comes up with in that as the years go by. But again, that's science fiction. I'm sorry. I also write sci-fi, so occasionally I slip, but I'm trying to stay more in fantasy on this one.
Makes sense. Wendy, tell us a little about where we can find your stuff.
Okay. I am Wendy Van Camp. I have a blog called No Wasted Ink. It's a blog for readers and writers of science fiction and fantasy. I interview up-and-coming authors. I review classic science fiction and fantasy books, usually Hugo and Nebula Award winners. You can see examples of my sci-fi coup, science fiction-themed haiku poetry, which I also illustrate. I am active on Medium. You can also find a lot of my short stories, the fantasy and science fiction ones, on Curious Fictions. And, of course, you can find my books on Amazon. The website is nowastedink.com.
Okay. Angelique?
Hi, I'm Angelique Anderson. You can find me on Amazon, Kobo, Nook, iBooks. So my books are everywhere, but I really enjoy interacting with people in my reader group, which is the Wiley Wordsmith. I'm also very interactive on social media. So pretty much author A.S. Anderson, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. I mean, pretty much any social media you want to talk with me or chat with me. I love interacting with readers, other writers, so on and so forth. So just send me a shout out.
And I'm Eric Klein. Like I said, I do science fiction and nonfiction, mostly security or tech writing. I can be found at ericlklein.com and on Amazon if you're interested in seeing what I've done to really insult Shakespeare and Swift.
Love that. That's a tagline.
Yes.